All right, the committee will come to order. Representative Lane, will you move the minutes of the February 4th meeting?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do.
All right, any questions or comments? All in favor of adopting the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. All right, the first, yes. Yeah, if you want to get going, that's fine. Sure. No, no, no. You got a rush? Yeah. All right, Representative Emmer. So, Representative Emmer moves that House File 176 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register.
Members, I'm going to introduce the people next to me in a second. Briefly, what this bill does, and I don't have it in front of me, I'll tell you what it does. This is a bill that would provide for amending a certified death certificate by court order in the event the court determines that the medical examiner's determination of death, causation of death, is incorrect. The people seated next to me, Brandon Schwartz, is with a law firm in Chanhassen, Minnesota. His firm handled a case for Mary Heft and her family after they lost their son. And they went through the entire process and were told that because of the way the law is drafted, there is no way to change a death certificate once it's been issued. In meeting with the health department, and we have someone here today who will confirm this, they tell us that had the court issued an order, which would have been in violation of the law, because the law didn't allow it, had they received an order, they would have amended the death certificate. So we're here with Mrs. Heft and her family to try and correct the law. And with that, I'd introduce Mary Heft.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you. My son's name is Ryan Martin Heft. He was a police officer with the St. Louis Park Police Department. And on November 6, 2001, Ryan died. His squad car was found at the base of a hill just off of Cedar Lake Road. The engine of his squad car was running, and a bullet from his service weapon was in his right temple. When his father and I were notified of Ryan's death, we were told that he most likely committed suicide. The Hennepin County Sheriff's Department did an investigation of Ryan's death, and upon completion of that investigation, I asked to see that death file. I read it from cover to cover, fully expecting to see details in there that would speak of a son that I didn't know, perhaps a son that was unhappy. But everything that I read, every interview that the Sheriff's Department did, spoke of the young man I knew, joyful, in love. The field training officer that sat beside him for his first 3 months, he was a rookie cop, so 3 months on duty. The officer that sat beside him said this young man was an excellent young officer and in love with life. So everything I read in that file said exactly what I thought that my son was like. So I called the Hennepin County Medical Examiner and I said, please explain to me why you're ruling suicide instead of accidental death. Can you explain that to me? And he said, and I quote, Mary, guns don't accidentally misfire. He went on to say that for my son's service weapon to have fired, he would have had to have gone through 5 steps. I don't know anything about guns, but my daughter, Ryan's sister, is a police officer with the Madison, Wisconsin Police Department. And when I told my daughter what the medical examiner said, she said, Mom, is he crazy? An officer in a life and death situation that would say, just a moment, step one, step two, step three, step four, fire? She said, we would all be dead. She went on to explain to me that officers in Madison, all officers in Madison, chamber a bullet in their gun, which means that only one step is needed for a bullet to fire. Only one step. And she was certain that my son had done the same with his weapon. So I then contacted one of my former university students, had taken a graduate program from Dr. Janice Amatuzio, who is the chief medical examiner for Anoka, Dakota County. And I didn't know her, but I called her and I said, could I ask you to do a favor? I said, could I ask you to please look at Ryan's death file and please tell me where in there you see suicide? I don't see it. And she said, yes, I think you deserve to know that. And so she took the file. And I didn't hear from her for 5 months, but 5 months later she called me. And she said, Mary, I need to sit in Ryan's squad car, I need to hold his gun, and I need a lot of questions answered. Then she contacted the lead accident reconstructionist for the state of Minnesota, Staff Sergeant Donald Schmolzbauer. And together they reenacted exactly how they believe that Ryan accidentally died and how his gun accidentally discharged when his squad car went up, suddenly up and down over a curb. Then they did a video reconstruction, and the St. Louis Park Police Department loaned them a squad car like the one that my son was in, and they closed off Cedar Lake Road for Dr. Amatuzio and Staff Sergeant Schmolzbauer. They did the reenactment. It came out exactly as they believed Ryan died. The bullet hit Staff Sergeant Schmolzbauer, the gun hit him in the temple exactly where Ryan's gun had hit him. So after that, they presented those findings to the medical examiner's office, complete with a video, which is available for your viewing if that's something that you would like to see. They presented it to the medical examiner, and then they told me, Mary, now it's just a question of waiting. He will change that ruling. He has to change that ruling. It was wrong. So a year passed, and I called the chief medical examiner. This time it was a new one. The former one had retired. And I spoke to him, and I said, can you tell me the status of Ryan's case? He said, Mary, we have no plans of changing that ruling. I said, can I ask you why? And again, and these were his exact words, Mary, guns don't accidentally misfire. Five steps were needed for Ryan's gun to discharge. It was then and only then that I realized we had to do something that we had no intention of doing. We did not want to go to court. But at that point, we decided we don't have another choice. So we went to district court only to find that in the state of Minnesota, a medical examiner's ruling is final. We challenged that to the appellate court, and the appellate court upheld the ruling of the district court, that a medical examiner's ruling is final in the state of Minnesota, that we did not have a right to go to court. So we're here before you today to ask you to please make it possible, to go to court and to challenge what's on a death certificate. This bill more than likely, if it does pass, more than likely will not be retroactive. More than likely it will do nothing to affect what's on Ryan's death certificate. But for officers in the state of Minnesota who carry their weapons and chamber a bullet in their gun and run the risk of death every day because that bullet is chambered in their gun and it could accidentally misfire at any time. For those young men and women who die, this is for them so that their families don't have to go through what we did. I would like to thank Representative Elmer, and I would like to thank you for considering this bill. Ryan's bill.
Mr. Chair and members, just so you know, the only reason that I've met Mary Heft because any one of you would be carrying this was I happened to know the attorneys that represented her, and they brought this to me. Otherwise, anybody in this room may have been sitting here with them. I'm going to introduce Brandon Schwartz, who's with the law firm that actually took this not only through the district court, but through the Court of Appeals and before they were denied by the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you. Like Mrs. Hess said, we...
If you just could identify your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Brandon Schwartz with Michael V. Schwartz, PA. Like Mrs. Hess said, we became involved after they tried everything they could within their power to change the medical examiner's opinion. And we are here because we were told by the Court of Appeals to come here. And I quote, they said, to the extent that the Hess are without the ability to challenge the accuracy of Ryan's death certificate in court, the proper body to remedy this circumstance is not the judiciary, but the legislature. We note that other jurisdictions have statutes that directly allow a challenge of the accuracy of a death record in court. While we are sympathetic to the Hess frustrations and the related hardships that continue to burden them, we are constrained by the limited nature of our judicial role. Now, what many of you probably know is that in Minnesota, a person with a tangible interest, such as a parent or a sibling, can get a copy of a death certificate, but they have no ability to ensure that it's correct. Now, in Minnesota, the plain language of the statute as it stands does not allow that, and that's what the court has said. They've stayed within the constraints of what they're able to do. Minnesota has also held that even feigning a suicide shows a direct lack of character. Now imagine what it's like when you have three independent, world-renowned experts tell you that that's not what happened, that their son didn't commit suicide. The Minnesota Constitution provides that every person is entitled to a remedy in the laws for a wrong, for an injury or wrong that is done to their character. Or Ryan's had an injury done to his wrong. He's been told that he committed suicide when he didn't. The Hess has had a wrong done to their character. Their families had to live with this burden. The legislature has previously recognized this when there's a vital record such as a birth certificate that was incorrect. Say it had the wrong parent's name on it. There's a statute that has been enacted to allow for a court order to correct it. And that's what we're proposing today. We're proposing to bring the two statutes in line with each other so that the vital records, you can correct them if they're wrong. Now, you know, the majority of the time, the medical examiner's right. And, you know, that's their job. But we believe that there should be a system of checks and balances put in place so that if they're wrong, they can be challenged and they can get it right. Now, I know that the big argument is, well, is this going to put medical examiners in court all day arguing whether they were right or wrong? No. The burden was on the parents or the brothers or sisters, people with a tangible interest, to get experts, to get admissible evidence within court to show that they were wrong. So there's no way that this is going to pull the medical examiner from their job of what they're supposed to do. Now, we've talked to different medical examiners and said, this would be great. So the medical examiners that are doing their job, they won't have anything to worry about. For the ones that made a mistake, and we're all human, everybody makes a mistake sooner or later, there should be a way to correct this. So we hope that with the enactment of this bill, that another family doesn't have to go through what the Hess did. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, I have a representative from the Health Department who is here to testify to their support of the bill. Before she comes up, I'll just tell you that yesterday they were in, and again, they said had they received a court order, this is something that they would have changed. They think this is a good clarification. They also have told us that there is no cost associated with doing it. And with that, I want you to come up, Barb. Here. Oh, you got it.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Emmer, Fox. My name is Barbara Wills. I'm an Assistant Division Director for Health Policy in the Minnesota Department of Health. This is the division that houses the State Registrar's Office, which has the responsibility for vital records registration in the state of Minnesota. We're here today. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. We have no problem with this bill at all. We believe that we lose any ambiguity that a court has the ability to direct the state registrar to correct the record. There are two ways to correct a record, and the department has worked with Representative Emmer to suggest the method that is the national standard and makes it easier for consumers to use the record down the road. The current process to amend the death record works well, and it is quite rare to get a court order to amend a death record, although we do get them and we do comply with them. We believe it will continue to be a rare situation, as Brandon just testified, and so we believe there are no fiscal implications to this bill.
Okay, thank you.
With that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for questions, but I do have two amendments that I'd like to offer.
The amendments.
The first amendment, I don't know if somebody will have to
the
tell
A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment.
So Representative Emmer moves the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Briefly what that is, that's the one that Barb just explained. The Health Department suggested we change it. The way the bill was originally drafted, you have a certified death certificate that's issued. If this law went into effect, someone could challenge that by court order. It could be changed. The problem was it would simply issue a second certified death certificate. They suggested, and I agree with it, and I use the analogy of a piece of real property where you have an abstract. When you have an incorrect legal description, you go to the court, you get an order, it directs someone in the property office to amend the abstract, to correct it. You can follow that through. This amendment would, in effect, create that process where now, with a court order, the office would simply amend the existing death certificate.
Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Ember, would you... I just noticed you need to fix the header, too, in line 1.2. It's a delete, a replacement, and insert, and amended. And this isn't my forte, so I don't know if someone wants to.
If Representative Gardner is offering a friendly amendment, I'll take it as that. I don't have
it. We'll just incorporate that into
That's
the
right.
header. Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Reedling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, with the amendment, would the old death certificate no longer be available? I mean, if the way you had it drafted before, somebody, if there was ever, say, any dispute about it, somebody could come in and get a court order and go back and at least see what was on the previous one. As you've got it now with the amendment, it doesn't look like you could ever do that. Like, it would be, like, the previous form would be completely gone. Am I right about that?
I think the original, Mr. Chair, Representative, what the amendment does is it actually allows you to have an audit trail so that you are able to see that there's a difference between the original death record that might have been issued and the second one. The original bill says you would substitute the original death record with the amended or the modified one, and then there'd be no way to tell the difference between them. There'd be questions, legal questions, which one is most current, which one is the legal death certificate. Whereas if you have an amended death certificate, you'd be able to see which one is the most current.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then one more little question on that. What happens to the confidentiality piece? Can anybody then go and see the audit trail?
Ms. Wilson.
All death records, Mr. Chair, Representative, all death records in Minnesota are public.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So essentially then, it sounds like I'm correct in thinking then that the confidentiality piece is being removed with the amendment here, because it's now the fact that it was amended and what it was before is now available to the public.
Ms. Well, I think the question is, if under the original language, would that first death record have just disappeared from the public view?
Is that no?
Oh. No, let me just. Well, it looks like she's ready to answer. Maybe she understood. Let me just repeat the question to make it really clear. Under the pre-amendment form of the bill, it says that the prior vital record shall be confidential. But now we're striking that sentence, and we've got this audit trail instead, and if death records are public, that says to me that anybody can go in and see what the change was. and see what it was before it was changed. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, you are correct.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess everybody must be okay with that part of it then. Right, Representative Emmer, you're satisfied with that? You don't mind that it's not going to be confidential?
Well, I think it's exactly the way it would have been before, except now it makes it easier to understand. I mean, the original death certificate, under the way the bill was drafted, would have been public. The one that exists right now, Representative Liebling, is available. It's a public record.
Mm-hmm.
The original draft of this bill would have made not only that original death certificate available to the public, but the subsequent one that was changed by court order. No other information would be available. That's the problem that the department's telling you they're trying to overcome, as I understood it, is you could potentially have two certified death certificates out there with different causes of death. This actually makes it clear you've got the original death certificate, which is now amended, and that's what I understand they call the audit trail, so you can see that it was changed. But you're not going to get any additional information.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not going to go any further with it, but under your original draft of the bill, you were making the prior one confidential.
Oh.
Now you're not. But I don't care.
That's what, yeah.
No, I don't. I'm basically trying to satisfy not only what this family's gone through, but what the department says. I mean, imagine, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, members, we've got another amendment that we'll talk about in a second, but imagine that you have this situation, or that we do, and that you go through 7 years of this, 6 years of this, and then you bring it to somebody that you don't know because they happen to be sitting in the legislature and they happen to know the attorneys that tried to help you, and the first thing you hear is, well, if we would have gotten a court order, we would have changed it. Well, I'm not looking to try and get technical with it. My understanding is this is acceptable to the department and any other family that's ever in this situation. I think we owe it to them to give them the opportunity if they want to go to all the trouble. So, no, I don't have a problem.
Further discussion on the amendment. Representative Lane.
We're wondering over here whether or not it could go back to clear it up for Ryan also. Is that too far back, or there... problems with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lane, that is the next amendment that we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. Seeing no further discussion on the A1 amendment, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. A2 amendment is your next one.
Mr. Chair, members, I would move the A2 amendment at this time.
Go ahead.
And I'm going to make an oral amendment to the A2 amendment because it's got a typo in it. It says January 1 of 2007. That should be January 1 of 2001. So I don't know if you...
We'll just incorporate that.
All right.
And members, the first amendment got here, I think, met the 24-hour rule. This one didn't, but I'm assuming no one's really going to have any... problems listening to this one, rather than leaving?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to discuss it just a bit before we vote on it.
Oh, I wasn't saying to vote on it. I just have it up for consideration.
Okay, well.
Because we didn't meet the...
All right, well...
But I don't see any, so go ahead, rather than leaving.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess that my question here now is when we go back to 2001, we were talking about there being no cost to it. And, you know, I think most of us are pretty aware that right now with our fiscal situation that the courts are under a lot of fiscal pressure and have been telling us, you know, please don't give us any new work to do. And so I guess my question, I heard you before and you said they're pretty rare, but I'm wondering not only about the fiscal effect on the department but on the courts and what this might mean when we're going back now a number of years. Do you have any sort of estimate about, other than the one case we know about, what are there other cases out there? Anybody have any idea how much this might cause the court?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, based on my conversation with the department, and specifically Jim Golden yesterday, he said this is just way too rare to put any cost on it. And in talking with Barb, she can tell you, if you'd like, I believe there have been 4 cases within the past 2 years. Did I do that wrong?
Mr. Chair and Representative Meadley, Representative Emmer, I just wanted to clarify that. We've had four court orders. To my knowledge, we've never received a court order to change the cause of death.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry, I feel like I'm doing the whole thing here, but, you know, of course, up till this point, if without this statute, the courts haven't really had authority to do it. So if you didn't have any, I guess that wouldn't be too strange, right, since they technically didn't have the authority. But is there any other way to know, when we're going back to 2001 now, you know, is there any other way to even estimate how many there might be?
Let me suggest the representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I just turned around and Mr. Schwartz is telling me if you look at the Court of Appeals decision, it's a matter of first impression, which indicates that in all the years, it's the first time it ever came up. So, I think that should give us a little guidance on the fact that if this was an issue, you would have seen it long before the HEF or even since. So, I would suggest that we look at the fact that there's only been one court case that's gone to the Court of Appeals.
What I'd like to suggest on this, because I think it is a legitimate question, we'll send it to the General Register, but if you can check with the judicial branch and, you know, follow up on that.
We will do that. Thank you.
Representative Moffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer. I'm a little concerned about having an effective date that's retroactive, and I wonder if there's a more elegant way, and I'm not a lawyer, you are, but maybe our counsel can think about that. I think it's bad practice in general to have laws that kind of sort of change the rules retroactively unless there's a really critical need, and I'm wondering if we might be able to have, instead of an effective date change, have a provision that says changes are authorized to be made for court decisions made in prior years, which is different than an effective date. But it's just, I think it's bad form to say we're going to change the rules going back, you know, 8 years.
Mr. Chair, if that's the proposal, I don't have a problem with that. I think the committee, Mr. Chair, based on Representative Lane's question earlier, I think they realized what I did today. And it wasn't until I sat down with the department yesterday and thought about it more, and then I went and asked Ms. Cleveland if we couldn't do something, because it just seemed to me that if I traded places with them, you know, after all this time, they should be able to change that death certificate.
It strikes me the way this reads is that the effective date will be today, but it just will be effective as the death records going back as well. And so, this amendment. So, I mean, I think it'll, I don't know, I think this will be okay. That's my opinion, sorry. All right, any other further discussion on this? On the amendment, yes. All in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Further discussion to the bill. Representative Liebling.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you. I know you don't even have to look over here anymore now, we know. But I wanted to ask you, Representative Emmer, whether, you know, we've heard about this one very compelling case for doing this, but can you just give us an idea of what other kinds of cases, or maybe the testifier from the department, you know, give us some idea of, you know, what kinds of errors result in somebody actually wanting to go back and change a death certificate other than the kind we're hearing about today?
An example for sometimes pending an autopsy, they don't have a cause of death to put on to a death record right away, and they have to go back and add it later. Sometimes we have an example where an individual passed away and he had been separated from his wife for many years, and inadvertently on the original death certificate it said that he had been divorced when in fact he was still married, so they went back in time and changed the marital status, that sort of thing. So the address of the doctor could be changed, that sort of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And What I specifically want to make sure that that we're really clear on here is, does this have any applicability at all to terminations of pregnancy? I mean, is there a death certificate when there's an abortion? Or, I just want to make sure that we're not in that field here at all. Am I right in thinking that this has nothing to do with that?
Ms. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, you are correct.
Okay, thank you.
And just one other question. I hate it. On this effective date, maybe Ms. Cleveland, is this going to does this make it effective immediately, or do we have to wait till August 1st for this law to actually go into effect?
Mr. Chair, members, it would be the kind of standard effective date of August 1st for the law, but it would be effective for death records that were issued as of January 1st. So on.
What? Do you want to do it? So
we'd like to do it immediately. I'm sorry. I missed that.
I just was, as we had that discussion. So I will offer an amendment to Section 4, which would say, what would it say? It's effective immediately. Upon enactment.
Mr. Chair, this act is effective the day following final enactment and is effective for death records registered as of January 1st, 2001.
Does everybody understand that amendment? Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That motion prevails. Anything further?
No, thank you very much.
Any other discussion, members? All right, Representative Emmer renews his motion that House File 176 be recommended passed and referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming down. Okay, now... on to the GAMC, Randy, or Mr. Chun, excuse me, to give us a little bit of overview on the GAM. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, Randy Chun with House Research. As requested, I'll be providing a brief overview of the General Assistance Medical Care eligibility, covered services, and a little bit about recipient numbers. I'll also provide a brief summary of the governor's proposed changes to GAMC eligibility. And I'll be referring to the information brief that's in your folders. It's the longer, you know, document of the two, but I'll not be going through the entire document. General Assistance Medical Care is a state-funded program that pays for health care services for low-income Minnesotans who are not eligible for other health care programs. And these individuals are low-income adults between the ages of 21 and 64 who don't have dependent children. The eligibility criteria for GAMC are listed on page 2 of the information brief. In general, to be eligible for GAMC, a person needs to meet income and asset requirements. They need to satisfy a 30-day durational residency requirement, and they need to meet a qualifying status for the program. In other words, they need to be a member of a specific group. And there are also a few other eligibility criteria listed at the bottom of page 2 that I won't go over now for this presentation. The income limit for regular GAMC, and by this I mean GAMC under which there's full coverage of services, is 75% of the federal poverty guidelines. And this is $7,800 a year for a household of one. And there's an asset limit of $1,000 per assistance unit. And these income and asset limits are listed in Table 1 on page 3 of the document. Certain items such as the household, household goods, and an automobile are exempt from being counted as assets. And the assets that are exempted are listed on page 5 of the document. And there's some higher income and asset standards that apply to persons who receive group residential housing payments. As mentioned, an individual needs to meet a qualifying status to qualify for GAMC. So in other words, you don't just meet the income and asset requirements, you belong to a specific group. This is a change that was implemented in 2006. And the qualifying statuses are listed on page 2 of the document on the bottom half. Basically, it's things like being eligible for general assistance or receiving group residential housing payments. You would be awaiting a disability determination from Social Security or the state medical review team, be entitled to Medicare due to end-stage renal disease, be unable to meet the Minnesota Care 6-month residency requirements, and I won't read the rest. Since September of 2006, GMC enrollees who are eligible for full coverage but who do not have one of these qualifying statuses have been required to enroll in the Minnesota Care program. So this is what is referred to as transitional Minnesota Care. So these individuals, when they're on Minnesota Care, are exempt for up to 6 months from the Minnesota Care premiums. They're exempt from the Minnesota Care income and asset limits and from the Minnesota Care insurance barriers. These individuals receive the Minnesota Care benefit set for adults without children. This is the benefit set that contains a $10,000 annual inpatient hospital limit. So the effect of this qualifying status requirement and this transitional Minnesota Care is that persons who remain on GMC, in other words, they're not moved over to Minnesota Care, are more likely to have a disability or a chronic health condition, while the relatively healthier individuals are transitioned over to Minnesota Care. And there's also a handout in your folder prepared by the Department of Human Services that provides some of the sort of demographic and other characteristics of the GMC population. Now, individuals with incomes that are greater than 75% of poverty but not exceeding 175% of poverty, so this would be a maximum of $18,204 a year for a household of one, are eligible for what is called hospital-only GAMC if they apply during an inpatient hospital stay. The coverage is provided under this option only for inpatient hospital services and physician services that are provided during a hospital stay, and a higher asset limit of $10,000 for a household of one and $20,000 for a household of two or more applies. I'd like to move now to covered services. These are listed on page 6 of the information brief. The GMC benefit set is not as rich as the MA benefit set. I won't read through the list, but GMC covers most standard healthcare services such as physician care, hospital care, prescription drugs, medical supplies. It also covers dental, vision care, and eyeglasses. The main services that are not covered by GAMC, but which would be covered by the medical assistance program, are home health care, nursing home services, independent therapy services, pregnancy and related services. And these pregnancy and related services, if a GAMC enrollee became pregnant, they would then qualify for either MA or emergency MA. So that's where they get those services. And also ICFMR services are not covered. Cost sharing applies for some of these services, and the cost-sharing requirements are on page 7 of the document.
John?
Yes?
Just on those, the services that aren't covered, mm-hmm. is that because people that would need those services would typically qualify for MA?
Mr. Chair, I think in the case of the pregnancy and related services, that's definitely the case. And in some cases, ICFMR services, the person would then be considered disabled and qualify that way, but I think it may have been also for cost reasons as well.
Thank you.
The covered services, again, for people who are eligible for hospital only are inpatient hospital services and physician services provided during an inpatient stay. There's a $1,000 deductible for each hospitalization for these individuals. Give you some figures on the number of GAMC enrollees. These figures are from the DHS November forecast, so they're not in the document in your folder. In fiscal year 2008, there were 28,165 enrollees in general assistance medical care. These figures are a monthly average for the year, and this number includes 21,328 persons who received full GMC coverage, 133 who received GAMC hospital-only coverage, and 6,704 people who don't meet a qualifying status and were therefore transitioned to Minnesota Care.
So only 133 are in the hospital only. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. It's a small number. I'd like to now move on to, I guess, describing the governor's...
Representative Laffer has a question.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Chun, on the hospital only benefit set, does that mean that they will not have reimbursed post-hospitalization therapy on an outpatient basis? You'd actually have to keep them in the hospital longer, or they'd have to absorb the cost?
Mr. Rector Blosser, the language does refer only to the services provided during hospital stay. So I think you're right about the options that the person would face. And
Representative Blosser.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chun, does the person in that situation have a choice of going on to regular GMC, or is it the hospital kind of arm twist them to make their bill is covered and they can't get on to the regular program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Blosser, these would be people who would be above the 75% of federal poverty guidelines.
Okay,
income limit. They wouldn't have that option.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, I'll go over the governor's proposals. The governor is proposing to eliminate the GMC hospital-only program and the transitional Minnesota care coverage for those enrollees without a qualifying status. He's also proposing to eliminate Minnesota care coverage for adults without children. The GMC hospital-only program would be eliminated on January 1st, 2010. Those enrolled in the program on that date would be covered for the rest of their hospital stay. The enrollment of GMC enrollees without a qualifying status into Minnesota care would end on January 1st, 2010 also. And this is tied to the proposal by the governor to eliminate Minnesota care eligibility for all adults without children, again, effective January 1 of 2010. And these individuals without a qualifying status would not be eligible to remain on general assistance medical care. So to sum up, if all of the governor's changes in GMC eligibility were implemented, GMC would be limited to those who have a qualifying status, who meet the 75% of poverty guidelines income standard, and who meet a $1,000 asset limit, as well as some other program criteria. So based on figures that are provided in the budget book, the effect of these changes would be to reduce the existing and future enrollment of adults without children in general assistance medical care and Minnesota care by just over 65,000 by fiscal year 2011. And that concludes my overview.
Thank you. Any other questions? I think that this cover page from DHS is pretty interesting with the demographic information. Thank you, Mr. Chun. And what we're trying to, one of the reasons here to have this hearing today is really just to get a better understanding of who we are serving currently in this program, how they access services, and is there another way are there other ways to better serve them than the way the current program is set up. So the next witness, Father John Estrom. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. Hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Father John Estrom. I'm the CEO of Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis. And each year, Catholic Charities serves about 40,000 people, regardless of faith. But that's just a number. That's just a statistic. The reality is that the story is the people. And their stories are getting really much more desperate in our community. Just as a very small snapshot, in January, nearly 6,000 people slept on the floor of the Dorothy Day Center, right down the hill. That's 300 more than in December. And we expect that on a per-night basis, the population is going to grow again now in February and then in March and in April and in the foreseeable future until the economy begins to turn around. It's always been true that the kind of clients that we serve at Catholic Charities are the first ones to suffer in a recession and they're the last ones to benefit when we start to come out of that recession. This time, unlike many previous recessions, What we're seeing at pretty much all of our sites, not just the Dorothy Day Center, but of all of our sites around the Twin Cities, is that many of our clients now are families. These are people who had a decent lifestyle, had done everything society had asked of them, and still now find themselves without a home and without a job, and increasingly without hope. I'm here to say that we cannot throw these people aside as a society. Regardless of the economic condition of the state, the best investment we can make as a people is in the people of Minnesota, in all the people of Minnesota. The economy is going to recover someday. I wish I knew when that was, but it's going to happen. And we need these men and women to be able to return to the workforce and again contribute to building the wealth of this state. Long-term recovery and long-term prosperity won't be in spite of people that today's budget proposal threatened to cast aside. It will really be because of them. Investing in people, to me, means meeting their basic needs of food, of shelter, and of health care. And failing to invest in people means that in the long run, it's going to cost us as a state and as a people more money to care for those who could not get health care because they could not afford it. Because the population we serve is very transitory, and there's a lot of mental illness within the population, it's very difficult to obtain very precise information. But we know that the vast majority of the people that we serve receive some type of government-funded health insurance, including GAMC. And GAMC is the last resort health insurance for so many of our clients. If they didn't have this, then the only option becomes to rely on much more expensive emergency services at hospitals. So the conversation, I believe, really needs to be broadened. Yes, it can be about GAMC, but that's just a piece of it. The conversation isn't about can we solve it in this biennium, in this particular budget? Because we can't just continue to sort of patch the Titanic after we've hit the iceberg. We can't keep putting people in lifeboats because all that does is prolong the drowning. We have to have a conversation about comprehensive long-term health reform that includes everybody, including the people who sleep on the floor of the Dorothy Day Center. We know that tough decisions have to be made. We know that the situation is not easy that is before you. But I'm here to say that while we know there will be cuts, we're willing to engage in conversation about the best way to do that, to have the least devastating long-term impact on the poor of our state. We would like to work with you to creatively develop solutions to the problem. We understand the problem. We're simply waiting for the invitation because we believe we have something to say. Not, we don't know policy all that well, but we know the poor. We serve them every day, and we have for over 140 years in this community, and we're not going anywhere. So we think we have something to say, and we'd love the invitation. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jerry Lauer. I'm the program manager for the Dorothy Day Center, one of Catholic Charities' day and night shelters. I'm going to follow up with some of what goes on at the Dorothy Day Center. Father John talked about the numbers and the increase we've seen. Last January in 2008, we were averaging 166 people a night on the floor. This past January, the numbers jumped to 213 people a night on the floor. These numbers are staggering as you spend your time watching, as there no longer is walking paths between the mats on the floor to allow for adequate safety precautions. When we started the overnight extended hours program at the Dorothy Day Center several years ago, what we understood we were talking about was 100 to 125 people a night sleeping on the floor. We had many discussions about what that would mean if we pushed near 150. Those days are long gone. My job has become more about managing people and less about meeting the needs of the people, moving them out of poverty. We still manage to get people out of poverty, but it takes much longer. It's much more difficult, and clearly the more people you have, the less time you have for each person. And we know what works best is that relationship. If you can establish a relationship, that trust comes and you can work with folks. I can tell you about our successes like a person in an electric wheelchair who spent 10 months living on the floor of the Dorothy Day Center. That person needed assistance getting from the wheelchair to the mat on the floor into the bathroom. It took us a long time, but we were able to move her out. One thing I'd like to do, though, is talk more about what we don't seem to have answers for. We have persons coming out of the hospital days after major surgery, stitches and staples from the abdomen through the chest region, sleeping on the floor with the other 200 folks. Very difficult to meet their health and hygiene needs in that situation. We have extremely mentally ill folks who are not taking their medication, are very vulnerable and unstable in large crowds. Mixed into that population, this past month, we served roughly an average of 15 very intoxicated folks in that same room. We are currently dealing with an active TB case that dates back to late 2007. The places that we see and work in are filled, and they're very difficult to track people down. So the active case that going back to 2007 is still being kind of discovered at this point, trying to get all the folks who were exposed access to some testing. If I step back and look at what cutting folks off GAMC will do, I see a disaster. The ever-increasing numbers we are serving will be even more susceptible to illness and injury that preventive medicine can resolve. Those coming out of the hospital with no place to stay will be coming to us in more dire situations and in greater numbers. The numbers of mentally ill persons not taking medication will increase. It won't just be the folks who are choosing not to take the medication, but it will be those who don't have access and it is available to them. Our intoxicated persons will be seeking treatment and won't have that available to them. But the overriding concern I have is places like the Dorothy Day Center will no longer be able to handle the ever-growing numbers of persons and health concerns that come with the population we serve. Not having access to medical treatment other than emergency rooms at hospitals will fill our facilities with populations that have enough barriers already right now to get back to getting housing and work. This is just a little glimmer of the work world that I am in. The numbers that pass through the doors of the Dorothy Day Center are staggering both day and night. I'd encourage you to get a hold of me and come down someday and spend some time and see the struggles that our folks have. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's good to see you both here.
Thank you.
We know some about the population enrolled in GAMC,
mm-hmm.
and here you are able to give us a real-life picture. I am wondering if you can tell us in either of the facilities in which you're engaged, if there is any effort to provide care, if there's care provision actually happening there. And as I am thinking about what we're facing, one of the things I want to make sure we're able to do is to make sure that we're still providing care. We might not be able to do it in the way that we're doing it right now, but I want to make sure the people who need care are getting care. So is there care being delivered? Do you have...
Are you speaking of medical care?
Health care, medical care, dental care. I've heard sometimes of dental hygienists going into clinics or homeless shelters and doing work. So I'm just curious about that. I'm curious about that.
I can answer a little bit and then... you hear about it because of how rare it is when it does happen. It's pretty rare. We're not a medical provider. That isn't, we provide really emergency services, life-saving kind of emergency services. But we've developed all sorts of competencies that we never expected to have to develop with a staff that's not really trained for that or educated for those things. When hospitals literally drop patients on our sidewalk, this happens with some regularity, not every day or every week, but often enough that it's not completely unusual when it happens. We have to figure out how to maybe help them change a bandage or get them connected to some other care. So
The answer is no and yes. The answer is no, we don't. And we don't intend to, we don't have the either the finances or the space to develop that kind of competency. But the truth of the matter is we deal with medical, we deal with mental health issues. We're not a medical mental health provider, but we partner with others who walk the floors of our provide some very basic mental health services. Do you want to say more?
Ms. Lott?
And that's at the Dorothy Day Center. We try and provide the opportunity for our partner agencies to come and provide that. But clearly, again, we're talking about space. When we're talking about numbers, it's very, very difficult. And the population that does get served there is, yet I would not want to downplay the help that's there, but clearly it's just scratching the surface. And the kind of cuts we're talking about right now would not only overwhelm that type of service, but I think it will add a dimension that is hard to understand.
Just to clarify, we're talking about a shelter. We do operate housing facilities. And for instance, at Mary Hall, which is right behind Dorothy Day, we have a partnership with a mental health provider that provides medication monitoring and some other things. It's a partnership actually with Ramsey County as well and with St. Joseph's Hospital. Because it keeps people from accessing the emergency room when they're having an episode that is caused by not taking their medicine. So we have some set-aside beds, 20, I think, in Mary Hall that provide this kind of enhanced service. So we do provide some of those kind of things because often it's you know, it's $350 a night in the psych unit of St. Joe's. We can do it for about $35 a night.
And part of that whole thesis is also built upon the premise that there's a shared responsibility. So I would bet that the GAMC prescription costs are being kind of factored into that. So you start pulling that stuff out, and when those prescriptions become unavailable, the stability of all those folks, it's just much more difficult.
So some of the funding streams come through our state programs. Okay.
Yeah.
We have three people who want to ask questions, but we have five witnesses left to go. So can we just move on so we can get the testimony in? Thank you for coming in. This is very helpful. And you'll be here if we get.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Nielsen, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Monica Nielsen, and I am the director of a street outreach program in Minneapolis at St. Stephen's Human Services. I decided to use a portion of my time to bring along with me a GAMC recipient, Sam. My comments will be brief. I work with people who do not have shelter. Some of those I've worked with this week slept behind the PetSmart, behind the dumpster in Plymouth, slept in a porta potty in a metro park, slept in a car up in Crocus Hill with her kids because she wanted to be near the big houses because she felt safer. This is in January, and this is in Minnesota. According to Metro Transit, about 50 people each night sleep on the buses in order to seek shelter. The folks I work with have a difficult time managing their health, especially chronic disease. It's obviously impossible to plug in a nebulizer when you're sleeping under a bridge. Fortunately, asthma or high blood pressure can be better cared for with GAMC. I'm not taking them to various emergency rooms around the metro area for their primary care, and I see the return on investment. I know that the picture will be different without access to medical care. Carrie was 26 and had a sinus infection. In her case, she hadn't yet obtained the health care to get the antibiotics. She ended up with encephalitis, was comatose for 6 months in the intensive care unit, and died. She was 26, and that was preventable with antibiotics. I know that people die, but what do you think was the cost of 6 months in the intensive care unit for us versus the cost of antibiotics for Carrie? As some people I work with ask me if they're going to lose their medical care people like Sam yesterday, my comment to them is the same I will say to you. These are dark days, but I believe there doesn't have to be suffering. The veterans outside tell me that the warrior ethos is to leave no soldier behind. They need to believe that even while they have their own veterans' benefits and try to protect the people around them who don't have health care benefits, they're still the protectors, just doing it under the bridge, that we, their protectors, you and I, are doing what we can to make sure that they have access to health care. We may wish that they would just move away, or we may think eventually they'll die, but our goal should be that no one is left behind either. I brought Sam along so that you would see how GAMC can make a life-changing difference.
Welcome. Committee members, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate you hearing us out today. I grew up here in St. Paul. My name is Sam. Specifically, I'm from the West 7th Street area. I went to Monroe High School, and I am a lifelong resident of Minnesota. Like most of us, I worked hard most of my life. I paid my taxes, and I pursued my dreams. For most of my life, my dreams came true. In 1995, through a set of unusual circumstances, I became homeless. During that time, though, I continued to work 75% of the time. I did this in spite of the fact that I had to sleep on park benches and many times on mats and on the floor of homeless shelters. I had an extremely different and trying time during this period. At the present time, I'm not homeless. For 3 years now, I've been living in supportive housing, and this was made possible in part by general assistance and general assistance medical care. And just yesterday, Monica here informed me that my medical assistance may be in jeopardy, and this has me very, very, very worried for these reasons. About 2 years ago, I started feeling some pains throughout my body, and I went through a year of medical tests to try to figure out what was wrong with me. Just every medical test you can think of, from colonoscopies to endoscopies to ultrasounds. And it took me a year to find out that I had an affliction known as DDD, degenerative disc disease. And part of the problem is I have high blood pressure because of the pain. On a really bad day, I can hardly get out of bed. On a really good day, with my pain medication, I can perform some daily tasks and come to a place like this. 2 days ago, I would not have been able to come down here. That was one of my bad days. Without general assistance medical care, I won't be able to pay for my pain medication, visits to my doctor, or for medical procedures. The things that I fear now are a life of constant pain, visits to emergency rooms. I'm also afraid I may be forced to choose between keeping my apartment and becoming homeless again so I can pay for my medications. I fear not only for myself, but I live in an apartment building with other residents that are in the same situation. And I'm sure they would love to talk to you, so if you'd ever want to come to our apartment building, they'll tell you their situation. At this point, I was going to end this, but I'm going to just add a couple more things because I see you're allowing me to talk. There are some what I believe are common misbeliefs about homeless people. As I told you in the beginning, most of my life I wasn't homeless, and I had pretty high-paying jobs. One of the beliefs is that all homeless people are drug addicts and alcoholics. I have never tried a street drug in my life, and I am not an alcoholic. And this lady's known me for 10 years, and she'll tell you that. So I had a set of circumstances that caused me to be homeless. Had I not gotten this degenerative disc disease, believe me, when I got into my housing, I would have been working again. That was my dream. So that was the irony of it. I survived on the street, and I worked. And the irony of it is a lot of the jobs that I worked when I was homeless were hard labor jobs with a lot of lifting. and that may have contributed to my medical condition. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd like to ask you one question. Are we really going to lose our medical care? I thank you.
Thank you. I have actually one question, and that is what when you are to get your prescriptions and to see the doctor, do you just is it a kind of a tip a clinic in the neighborhood that you go to, or how does that work? Is it the hospital, or is it?
I go right now. I am.
If I can ask that,
sure.
If it's okay.
My family doctor is in Uptown, and I have a doctor also at the pain clinic, interventional pain clinic, that's treating me. And I'm receiving their shots. I'm not a doctor, but I'm receiving shots like every 3 months, which is it's helped some, but it hasn't helped a whole lot. And he prescribes my pain pills for me, and I see him like every 2 months. And I'm right now seeking possible other means of correcting my problem. I don't know what they all are, but I know I have a very difficult disease.
Thank you. That's helpful. Yeah, Representative Abel.
Just in brief, and I'll maybe answer this question a little bit. Mr. Joyner, thanks for coming. The process you're in here is you're reacting to a proposal made by the governor, which he admits he doesn't like all of it either. And you're talking to some of the decision makers who will decide how to find a way to balance the deficit, none of whom in this room want to cut your program. And so they're going to go out of their way to find ways to be creative and protect people like you and me amongst. And so any ideas you have along the way would be helpful. But there's no one in this building who's gleeful about any of this stuff. And so it's good to come to remind us of the faces of who we want to look after as well as the rest of Minnesota and so on. I hope that helps a little bit for you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Keeley? Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bert Keeley. I'm a physician at Regents Hospital. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and discuss Regents' experience in caring for the GAMC population and the impact that the governor's proposal will have on our ability to serve this population. I started at Regents 18 years ago as an intern, back when it was called St. Paul Ramsey Medical Center. I currently am a hospitalist. I'm internal medicine trained. A hospitalist, for those of you who don't know, is a physician who cares for patients only in the hospital. So I consider Regents Hospital my professional home. It is in my heart, and I'm honored to care for the many patients who come to us to seek help there. The individuals who come here represent the most vulnerable population in our community, as you've heard from witnesses before. The uninsured, low income, and all too often experiencing behavioral health issues. GAMC enrollees typically live near and seek services from the large urban hospital-like regions that are known to deliver charity care. I'd like to provide you with a brief profile of some of the patients that we see. A 59-year-old man with a pension as his only income arrives at Regents in cardiac arrest. He was in the hospital for several days. His total bill was $90,000. A 50-year-old man with diabetes and hypertension. He arrived at Regents after being in a motorcycle accident. He suffered multiple traumas. He was hospitalized, debilitated for an extended period of time in the hospital. He was uninsured, and his bill was over $500,000. A 40-year-old uninsured woman came in through the emergency department with both physical and mental health issues. She was treated for a suicide attempt and depression. She was uninsured. A 62-year-old female admitted to the hospital with a pulmonary embolism, a blood clot in the lung, acute respiratory failure, and cardiac issues. She's unemployed. Her husband received Social Security. She's unemployed. She's uninsured. As you can see, these patients vary in age, gender, complexity of the care that they need. Cutting them from GAMC will not keep them from getting sick. It's just going to leave them without insurance coverage. We all know that lack of coverage will result in them not getting the care they need, as we've just heard from Sam. And the services that they are going to get are going to end up being in our emergency department of our hospital and other hospitals around the city. Very expensive care to deliver. It's not the right care that they need. From Regents Hospital standpoint, the elimination of GAMC is really going to have a devastating impact on our ability to care for these patients. The loss of payments anticipated for 2009 will be $6.2 million. I understand the state is facing tough economic times. However, I don't agree with the approach of eliminating care for these patients. The governor's recommendations adversely affect disadvantaged patients and the safety net providers who care for them, and ultimately is going to result in higher costs to the system. I respectfully request that you consider these facts as you deliberate the governor's budget proposal. Thank you for this opportunity to testify and tell you about Regents' experience.
Any questions, members?
So the folks, the GAMC recipients that you see, do you see that they're typically getting kind of routine care, or do they more often than not, what's your experience with that?
Yeah, more often than not, they don't get the care they need in their primary care clinics. And so as a hospitalist, I see them when they've essentially fallen through the cracks. So when they've not taken their medicines, their care has gone off the deep end, and they end up at our door. We do everything we can to care for them. We make them as good as they can be within the confines of our door. But then when they leave, the cycle starts again.
Representative Lopper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, how about the situation of the people who are on GMC hospital only? And not having follow-up care, has that in any way changed or compromised how you treat those individuals before discharge?
I can't answer that question.
President Bond.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. Just a follow-up question to Chair Thiessen's original line of questioning in terms of, do you have any sense of, even though they are in a program that would provide them primary care, as to why these patients have not been taking advantage of that so as to prevent the emergency admissions?
Well, I think when people have the ability to get care but perhaps don't seek it out, there are multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. As you've heard, they may not have the ability to get there. Transportation's an issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's very complicated as to why they don't seek out help. We just know that when they arrive, we do what we can to care for them.
All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Ms. Quincy and Ms. Mason, do you want to come together? Are you coming together? Okay. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chairman and committee members, I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak with you today. I'm Ann Quincy. I'm an attorney in the Government Benefits Unit of the Legal Aid Society, Minneapolis. Primarily, I represent clients who are going through the Social Security Disability Appeal Process, Appeal Process for Disability Benefits. But that process, unfortunately, takes a long time. And so many of my clients, while they're waiting for those kinds of benefits, if they're unable to work or work very little, are relying on GAMC for their health care. And I'd like to talk to you about a couple of those clients. One is Rachel. Rachel smashed her arm as a young woman at about 20, her left arm, her dominant hand, in a terrible accident in 2001. The bones never healed correctly. She got not very good care there, but she did get some care. But orthopedic doctors had to re-break her arm in 2003. Again, it didn't heal well, and she suffered with what's called non-union. The bones actually didn't stitch together, and she was in a lot of pain. Her left arm had no function and then began to atrophy. Finally, in 2006, she had a prosthetic elbow implanted. I imagine that was very expensive. She was unable to work during most of that time. She waited too long to apply for disability benefits, frankly. She applied for disability benefits in 2006, after the surgery. That process with appeals took about a year and a half. During that time, though, the prosthesis actually healed. It actually worked. Today, just recently, in fact, Rachel has been able to go back to work after many years of being unemployed. She's earning $11 an hour. She's paying taxes. But for the general assistance medical care that she had in that period, she would not have been able to get the medical care that she needed to recover the use of her hand. Another client, Frank, has not been as lucky. Frank was diagnosed with chronic lymphocytic leukemia in 2003. He was treated and in remission until 2007, though. He applied for Social Security when he was diagnosed with having active leukemia when he came out of remission in 2007. He had what's called a transformation of his chronic leukemia. It became active. He underwent a transfusion, very lengthy and painful chemotherapy. Luckily, he again went into remission. Age and the cancer treatment, however, took a real toll on him, and Frank had to cut back on his work. He was able to go back to work, but only 15 to 18 hours a week. He's earning minimum wage. Any more than that kind of work really exhausts him. He's tried to put together 2 days at a time and found that he can't get out of bed the next day. He earns between $450 and $500 a month. He's barely making more than what general assistance would pay, and I suspect his doctor would say that he can't work at all, but instead he works. And he gets general assistance medical care coverage for his ongoing cancer and his medical, for his ongoing cancer care, but also his other medical problems. Without it, he would not only probably be unable to work, he'd likely die. I believe we'll be successful in getting Frank his Social Security benefits after the long, long wait that he's had since 2007. We look like we're closing in on it. And if he wins his Social Security case, he'll move to medical assistance. And the state will be able to get paid back for the general assistance medical care that they've provided, that they've covered, half of it, with the federal match for the medical assistance that Frank's care will be paid for with. My clients and I are very grateful that they have the GAMC program to keep them healthy while they wait for other benefits, and I urge you to preserve the program.
President Hulley.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Quincy, is that retroactive, the GAC payments that the state made for this individual, if it was determined from the time he applied for SSI, but it takes 2 years to get it, then they will pay half of what we paid?
The repayment period that the state can bill medical assistance, Medicaid, for is 2 years for reimbursement of the medical costs that they've incurred under the GAMC program. They get the federal match. They don't get 100% of the care. They get 50%.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Quincy, finally, I've been making a list of questions to ask at the end, but you've hit on it now, so I'll raise it now. Which is, in listening to some of the previous testimony, it struck me that the gentleman with the disc, you know, problem now, that I don't know if I know enough about SSI, but my sense was that if you had a disability that would prevent you partially or completely from being able to work because of something that was a diagnosed disability, that you could apply for things like SSI. Also, I may be wrong, but I also assume that if you were mentally, in terms of mental illness, diagnosed as, you know, disabled by that, maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't know enough about it, would also be able to access those kinds of benefits. And obviously, from the Dorothy Day Center and other kinds of testimony, we know that a lot of mental illness is a large part of the homeless community, that kind of thing. So, based on your knowledge of those areas, to what extent do you think a lot of these populations, if they could access the system of getting SSI, could potentially in the long run get that, or is there portions of these populations that would just never qualify through this process?
Chairman, Representative, thank you very much for that question. It's a really good question because part of what I want to tell you all is that, yes, many people would be eligible for this other benefit. Part of the, we at Legal Aid, actually, part of what we do in terms of representing people, we get reimbursed for from the Department of Human Services because we've moved them from general assistance, which is purely state paid, to a federal benefit. And that's great. It's more money. It's better medical coverage. Unfortunately, that process takes a long time. What we see, what's really sad, is what we see is someone who applies, and if you applied in Iowa for disability benefits in January of 2008, you might wait till January of 2010 to be told that you were eligible, and during that entire period of time, you wouldn't have any health coverage. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have been getting medical care. Well, we can't build a disability case if you can't get into the doctor. So what we're doing is setting up barriers to people getting the benefits that you think will help them if they can't get medical care in the interim. So they need the health coverage to make sure that they can then establish the disability. And yes, it does cover mental illness as well.
Ms. Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rolanda Mason. I'm a supervising attorney at St. Cloud Area Legal Services. And in that capacity, one of the things that I do is I supervise a Minnesota healthcare outreach program. Our office works with people in 19 counties throughout central Minnesota and assists them in going through the application and approval process for all of Minnesota's state and federally funded healthcare programs. One of the things that has surprised me or interested me as I was looking back at the numbers of people that we helped is to see of all of the people that we assisted in becoming enrolled in a Minnesota healthcare program, how many of those people were people who qualified for DANC. And we found that in the last 6 months of our program, 23% of all of the people who qualified for a Minnesota healthcare program qualified for DANC. And interestingly, that number increased from the third quarter to the fourth quarter. In the third quarter, it was 18% of all of the applications we worked with, while in the fourth quarter, it was 27%. So I sat down with my staff and I said, let's talk about why this number went up. You work with these people individually. Tell me why we've seen an increase in this number. And what they told me was that more and more people are coming in and telling them that they need to apply for health care coverage because they've recently lost their job. And without income, they may have had health insurance available to them through their previous employer, or maybe they didn't, but they were able to qualify for Minnesota Care and pay a premium, but now they have no income. And so they meet the very limited eligibility criteria that Mr. Connick went over with you in the very beginning and qualify for DANC. What scares me a lot about the proposal that the governor put forth in eliminating so many portions of the DANC program is that a significant number of those people would not be eligible under the governor's proposal because many of these people, and I suspect most of that increase that we've seen between 18 to 27%, are people who do not meet one of those special qualifier conditions. They are people who are relatively healthy. They can work at least to some degree and in some capacity. They're not disabled and applying for disability benefits, but they simply have little to no income. And I want to give you a couple of quick examples of the kinds of people that we see.
We have about 2 minutes.
Okay. I'll try to make it real fast. First, I'll talk about Roger. He lives in Isanti County, and he has some mental health disabilities that preclude him from working a full-time job. He's fiercely proud of the job that he does have. He works part-time to the full extent of his capacity. He has asthma also, and the job that he has is as a janitor in a manufacturing plant. It is imperative that he be able to have health insurance so that he can get his asthma medication. He would be in much trouble without it across his life, but he certainly wouldn't be able to work if he didn't have it. The company that he works for doesn't provide health insurance for people who work as few of hours as he does. Roger qualifies. His income is so low, it's below $650 a month, which is the DANC limit. So he qualifies as a very poor individual, but he doesn't need a special qualifier. So he's on the DANC Transitional Minnesota Care Program. If that is eliminated, he will lose his health care, he will lose his access to the doctor, and inevitably he will lose his job. Another individual, which is also very typical of the people that we see, is Doug. And Doug is someone who had a job that paid insurance benefits, and which was really good because he has a host of chronic medical conditions, all of which were maintained with medical care. He was able to work that job until he was downsized and lost that position. He got a new job, but unfortunately that new position didn't offer insurance, so he had to stop going to the doctor. When he stopped going to the doctor, his condition worsened until the point where he was ultimately unable to work. He came to us. We assisted him in filling out an application. He was approved for general assistance medical care, transition coverage, because while his conditions are significant, they're not disabling, and so he didn't need a special qualifier. He was luckily able to get the care that he needed. He's had one surgery to take care of some of the deterioration that came from the lack of medical care during the period he was uninsured. He's expecting to have a second one, and he told me just the other day that his doctors have given him the news that he's recovered so well from his first surgery that they expect that after his second surgery he will be able to go back to work. Without general assistance medical care, this was a man who saw his only future being disability benefits. But instead, he's now excited about returning to his employment. This is a vital program that ultimately puts people back to work, keeps employed people at work. I understand that you all are going to be having to make some very difficult choices with our budget situation, but I'm reminded of a saying that my grandmother used to say, don't be penny wise and pound foolish. The money that you spend on GAMC is an investment in our future, and without it, we end up spending more money in the long run. Thank you.
Thank you. And it is interesting on the sheet that Mr. Chun gave us that 73% of the people in JMC are 2 years or less on the program. So that kind of affirms what you're just saying. We do have to get out of the room. I'm sorry. But thank you all for coming. One announcement. Next Tuesday, we're going to have one long hearing, Tom's, Representative Huntley's committee and this committee, on the effect of what's going on in the healthcare industry, not even related to the budget, but just in general. And so we're not going to be kind of having the DFL, or I don't know if you guys use that time for your Republican caucus. That won't be here next Tuesday. Thank you. We're adjourned.